The race for governor is officially underway, with Governor Walker launching his re-election campaign this week. He says voters won't hold it against him if he doesn't meet his campaign promise to create 250,000 jobs in his first term. Do you agree? And he won't commit to serving a full 4-year term if reelected. Does that bother you or not? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're tuned to the Ideas Network. We have two guests from different viewpoints to discuss the top stories in state and national politics, and we invite your views too. We also invite the issue that you would like to discuss at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Matt Rothschild is with us, senior editor of the Progressive Magazine. Good morning.
Hey, Joey. Good morning. It's beautiful out.
It is beautiful out. Steve Prestigard is with us, journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com. Is it beautiful in Platteville, Steve?
It looks nice. Maybe we'll finally get rid of the snow. Actually, the snow is gone thanks to it's actually blown away because of all the wind we've had the last few days. And it is certainly about time that we have a season that approaches spring, even though, of course, as everybody knows in Wisconsin, normal spring is kind of not really anyone else's definition of normal.
Well, it's true, but I mean, we deserve to have a little nicer weather these days. In southern Wisconsin, things are starting to shape up. It's going to be decent for the next week or so, but poor northern Wisconsin, areas that got 10 to 16 inches this week of snow. And I posted a picture on Facebook of a person in an Easter Bunny costume in Minocqua shoveling shoveling his or her walk. I'm not quite sure who it was, but
I bet people didn't think that was very funny either.
I'm
not sure where the line is. I believe it's somewhere around Abbotsford, the 45 degree north line. And I have always, that is halfway, you know, halfway to the equator, halfway to the North Pole. I have always vowed I am never, ever going to live north of that line. I don't you know, the weather is bad enough in this state without living closer to the North Pole than the equator.
Well, you know, we're talking about the misery of long winters and the springs that don't arrive. But I know, Matt Rothschild, and maybe listeners don't, you love this time of year because you're a pretty big birder. You enjoy looking at the warblers and others, right?
Yeah, I've been bird watching since I was 4 years old, and these are the most fun 4 to 6 weeks in the calendar as far as I'm concerned, because you have the kinglets and the thrushes and then the warblers and the orioles and the grosbeaks and the tanagers all just parading through the state here one after another in the next 6 weeks, and it's just going to be thrilling to see.
It's a great time of the year. And, you know, this week marked the start of Governor Walker's reelection campaign. He formally launched his campaign. The presumptive Democratic nominee will be Democrat Mary Burke, Madison School Board member, former Commerce Secretary, and former Trek bicycle executive. Let me just start just with general assessments. Steve Prestigard, what's your analysis of this race for governor in Wisconsin?
Well, the last couple of poll results that I saw, I believe one of them is yours, Wisconsin Public Radio in St. Norbert, demonstrate that Scott Walker has if I put the Marquette poll and your poll together, it's got a lead, depending on how you count it, of 7 to 14 points. And interestingly, even though Walker's number is different in those two polls, Mary Burke's number is, I believe, exactly the same, 41%. And that can't be good news because she's introduced a jobs plan. She's gotten endorsements of unions, despite the fact that she has not come out and said, that she's going to repeal Act 10. I don't see the Burke campaign getting a whole lot of traction out there. Now, obviously, it's early. Things could happen. Normal people are probably not really paying attention to the governor's race or any other fall politics at this point, but at least at the start, it doesn't look very good for Burke.
And what's your assessment, Matt?
Well, I think that's probably a good picture of what's going on right now. But, it, you know, remember when Tammy Baldwin announced and Tommy Thompson was in the race for Senate, everyone was saying Tommy was going to win. And it may be that Mary Burke is like Tammy Baldwin in that the more people get to know her, the more they like her. And she hasn't been out there enough for a lot of people in the state really to get to know her. There are a couple questions out there. One, are there enough people undecided still on Scott Walker that she has enough room to convince enough people to vote against him and to vote for her? And the other question is, those people who didn't like Scott Walker but voted for him anyway during the recall election because they didn't think what he'd done had risen to the level of recall, are they going to then say, well, we gave him his full term and, you know, I'm going to go for this other person now because we gave him a chance? I don't know how that cohort of voters is going to go. If they start turning against Walker, that'll be good news for Mary Burke.
Well, the governor said that the state created more than 100,000 new jobs since the start of his first term, but he didn't mention in that announcement that he promised to help the state create 250,000 jobs. He was asked about it later by reporters, and he said something along the lines that that voters are not going to hold it against him if he doesn't make that 250,000 job mark. Do you think that's right, Steve?
I think that is the case. There is a I was somewhat critical of the jobs pledge because I didn't think it was specific enough, you know, good paying jobs, private sector jobs, you know, and other criticisms I had. There is a phrase from Vince Lombardi that comes to mind. In fact, it's my favorite phrase from Vince Lombardi, that if you seek perfection, you catch excellence. I just heard this morning, as a matter of fact, that the unemployment rate in the state has dropped to apparently 5.9%. That is nearly a full percentage point below the national average. And the other thing is, Matt pointed out, he asked the question of how many undecided voters there are. I think you could probably count on maybe your hands and your feet the number of total undecided voters in this state because of not just the 2010 election, but also all the recalls. So ultimately, even for reasons that are not tied directly to, well, did I make the pledge or not? I don't think there are many people that is really going to be a factor. They're either going to vote for Scott Walker or they're going to vote for Mary Burke, and they made their mind up well before this.
Mm-hmm. What about that pledge? Will voters hold it against the governor if he didn't make the 250,000?
Well, and part of it is how cynical are the voters? How cynical are the politicians? I mean, it is certainly very cynical for the governor to say, well, no one should fault me for having, you know, high goals. He didn't even get halfway to the goal, and that was his big pledge. So if you were just grading him on what he said he should be graded on, he should get a failing mark. Yeah, I guess he's used to failing marks. But look, it's very cynical, I think, for an elected official to say, essentially, who cares? I didn't meet my goal. Or to say, I don't know if I'm going to, you know, fill out my term or not, but vote for me anyway.
Let's take a call from Buck in Johnson Creek. Hello, Buck. You're on the air.
Good morning. I don't think it's about what he said he was going to do or what he did. It's what he should have done. And if Wisconsin's gross domestic product is about average, so if we took 1/50th of our national average in job growth and looked at what Wisconsin should have done, we should have created at least 140,000 jobs. And if you look at what Jim Doyle did in 2010, he created over 31,000 jobs, and the national average would have been under 25,000. So he was over 25% above the national average. And if you look at a year prior to his reelection from the recall and a year after, more jobs were created the year before than the year after. So I don't know how you can start blaming the protesters, especially when you get into the numbers and look at where the jobs were lost, like Oshkosh, the industries, where it's disposable income, accommodations, leisure, food service. You know, that's from taking money out of the hands of people who spend it in our economy. It's not giving tax breaks to corporations.
All right, Buck. Steve, what's your reaction to that?
Well, let's see. That because the supposed job numbers gain in 2010 would have been the year after the state lost 190,000 jobs, and Jim Doyle was the governor, and Democrats controlled the legislature. That is a fact. As for the Oshkosh jobs, the job losses were at Oshkosh Truck, which has a huge portion of its business in defense, and Scott Walker doesn't have a thing to do with the Defense Department Barack Obama does. So if you're going to lay that one down, why don't you ask Tammy Baldwin why it is that the federal government is making job cuts or is canceling contracts with Oshkosh Truck, resulting in job losses in this state. But, as I said before, I think this is the vast, vast, vast majority of people in this state have already decided who they're going to vote for. Clearly, the caller would not vote for Scott Walker under any circumstances. I think that's safe to say. And I believe that there's just a handful of people in this state, one way or another, who have not decided how they're going to vote for in this race. And ultimately, I don't think that number of undecided people is as large as the margin it's going to end up.
Well, let me, before we get Matt to respond, just add this, that Mary Burke this week is saying it's time to hit the panic button on the economy. She said that manufacturing is not a growth sector that Wisconsin can rely on and that the state needs diversity in its economy, as she was criticizing the performance of Governor Walker. Your thoughts on that, Matt?
Well, I think she's going to regret her choice of words there, both segments of that. You know, for a candidate to talk about hitting a panic button, it doesn't inspire confidence in a lot of voters. It's an expression, and I think she was just throwing it out there probably wasn't the best one I would have used if I were her. And manufacturing, she's from the manufacturing sector. She believes in manufacturing jobs, and she said that at almost every campaign stop. But to just say, we're going to be declining, or just to have that, to say that and then have that quote dangle out there out of context, as a lot of newspaper reports had it, it makes her appear to be anti-manufacturing, which is just quite contrary to what she's all about.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about another follow-up to the governor's announcement that he was running for governor, that he was going to run for re-election. He was asked by reporters if he was going to commit to a four-year term if re-elected, and he kind of sidestepped those questions, does not commit to the full 4 years, presumably Steve Prestigard, because he wants to run for president in 2016.
Well, let's keep in mind, however, a little history here, which is, first, Tommy Thompson was elected to his fourth term in 1998. He didn't finish because George W. Bush named him Secretary of Health and Human Services. Before that, Patrick Lucey got reelected governor in 1974 to a four-year term, and he did not finish that because President Carter named him ambassador to Mexico. So it's not like this situation is, 100% unique. It is entirely possible that a Republican not named Scott Walker could get elected president in 2016. That person might look at Walker and say, hey, you ought to be in my cabinet. So I don't particularly think that's even very interesting. To use a counter term, back before he was defeated, Russ Feingold was listed as a potential candidate for president, and I don't think there were liberals asking the question, or Democrats asking the question, well, what if he doesn't finish his term for president, or for Senate? So,
yeah, this is an unfair question, Matt.
Whatever happens will happen. Yeah.
So, Matt, is it unimportant, unfair to even ask that question?
Well, it's certainly not unfair to ask it, and it gets back to the question of, how we as voters view our role. I mean, are we just going to be spectators in this whole kind of farce that is the nominating and election process for presidential candidates, and just go along with the pundits and everybody else and just kind of cheer as though we're cheering or booing for whichever team we like? Or are we going to take our responsibility seriously and be members of the hiring committee for the person who's going to run this state? And if you're on that hiring committee, one of the first things you ask someone is, how long are you going to be in this job? This is a four-year job. You're going to be here for 4 years? And if the person waffles, I'd kick that person out of the hiring meeting.
This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking today to Matt Rothschild and Steve Prestigard, and with you, too, if you'd like to join in as we discuss the top state and national political news stories at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is The Week in Review on the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. Every Friday at this time, we talk with two guests from different political viewpoints about the top stories in state and national politics, and we invite your views, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. Talking today to Steve Prestigard, journalist and blogger at steveprestigard.com, and Matt Rothschild, senior editor of the Progressive magazine. Let's continue our discussion about the race for governor, officially underway with Governor Walker this week launching his campaign for re-election. Mary Burke got a false rating from PolitiFact this week for her statement that Wisconsin is one of five states with no equal pay law on the books, which was something that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had itself reported, as had a report from the American Association of University Women. So what's Steve, what's your reaction to PolitiFact giving Mary Burke a false rating and then giving the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel a false rating?
I read the thing for the Daily Kos. I think it was one of the funniest things I've ever read, unintentionally. The Daily Kos piece, for those who didn't read it, essentially claims that the Journal Sentinel is a mouthpiece for the Republican Party. And I think all of the people, all the conservatives who have read the Journal Sentinel and read all the leaks out of the John Doe investigations would find that just absolutely fall off your chair amusing. This is the thing about the Journal Sentinel. The company, and I used to work for them. I've worked twice for them. They're the one employer, actually, I've had more than anybody else in my career. And you know what the Journal Sentinel is about? Journal Sentinel is about making money because it's a business. And the Journal Sentinel, the newspaper, makes their own coverage and editorial decisions, and the radio stations, which is really where they're complaining, is about their own, you know, making their own coverage and editorial decisions. And it just drives people or organizations like the Daily Kos nuts that the company employs Charlie Sykes. I read the there are as many complaints about PolitiFact from conservatives and Republicans than there are from liberals and Democrats, but the idea that the Journal Sentinel is a mouthpiece for the GOP is just absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. Any thoughts, especially on this PolitiFact rating of Mary Burke making a false statement and then saying, oops, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel started it?
Well, yeah. I think it's terribly embarrassing.
Wait, no, it's Matt's turn.
I think it's...
Oh, sorry.
You know, if I'm at the Journal Sentinel, I'm pretty embarrassed by that. If I'm one of the editors over there, and you know, if you're going to do something like fact check or PolitiFact, and set yourself up as the arbiter of truth and falsehood, you better get your facts right, and that's job one in journalism. Steve said one thing that I totally agree with, and that is that the Journal Sentinel is about making money. All our corporate news outlets are about making money, not giving us the news, not telling us what's going on in the world, not trying to make us better citizens. And that's a real crucial point that my friends Bob McChesney and John Nichols make in their Death and Life of American Journalism. We got to do something about the crisis of journalism, which shouldn't be about making money, but should be about educating us and telling us what's going on in the world. The fact or the suggestion from Steve that the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is opposed to Scott Walker, when they have Charlie Sykes all over the place and when they've endorsed Scott Walker a couple times, I think that is open to question, certainly.
Yeah, what Wisconsin perhaps is one of five states that removed a Lilly Ledbetter type law from the books? Isn't that what happened? I mean, we still have an equal pay for women law on the books, but we don't make it. We're not going to make it easier for women to sue for discrimination. Isn't that what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, this is just part of the whole Walker agenda to give as much as he can to his corporate benefactors as fast as he can. And this is just another example that, I mean, he's for corporate rights, not for women's rights or, you know, the protecting the environment with the mining law and all that other stuff that was written by the mining company. So it's part and parcel of the whole Walker agenda.
Let's take another call. Catherine in Lake Tomahawk. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, good morning. I'm looking out at all the beautiful snow.
Oh, you've got a lot of beautiful snow. That's sorry about that, Catherine.
Yeah. My question for Matt and Steve is, when people are thinking about voting for the governor, Scott Walker's already declared he's running for president in 2016 or done everything but that. So I'm just wondering, why would I vote for someone who has shown that he is unlikely to be as loyal to the Wisconsin people as to his presidential ambitions and the ultra-wealthy who are financing them?
Well, I guess Steve should start with that.
Because I, on balance, agree with most of what Walker has done. And you have no idea whether or not he will actually run for president. I guess I'm still more skeptical about that than most people appear to be. But, you know, past performance is a pretty good indicator in politics of what's going to take place. And I've voted for Walker twice. I plan on voting for him again unless something radically changes. And, you know, I honestly don't care what he ends up doing after he gets elected, whether he runs for president or not. Because, you know, most people who run for president don't win. So if he runs and doesn't win, he'll still be in the state unless he resigns. So that doesn't have really very much bearing at all on my decision as who I'm voting for governor.
Matt?
Well, I think Catherine raises an interesting question as to whether Scott Walker is loyal to Wisconsin citizens. Certainly, I don't think he is loyal to Wisconsin citizens when he himself said he was going to drop a bomb on the people of Wisconsin. I don't think he was loyal to the citizens of Wisconsin. I think he's loyal to the Koch brothers and loyal to the GTAC mine and loyal to the charter school lobby. And yes, he's definitely going to run for president. He's going to have more money than God because those people are going to support him.
You know, we should probably move on to some other top stories in state politics, including two longtime Republican lawmakers calling it quits, at least since our last week in review. It was on Friday that State Senator Mike Ellis said he's not going to run for re-election. And shortly after that, longtime Republican Congressman Tom Petri of Fond du Lac said he would not run for re-election in the 6th Congressional District. It turns out that at least in Tom Petri's case, he had just learned of a Republican primary challenger in State Senator Glenn Grothman. I've started with Steve on most of our topics so far. So let's let Matt start on this one. What's going on here? Why are these two longtime, supposedly moderate Republicans bowing out, Matt?
Because the far right wing of the Republican Party has won. I mean, this isn't your father or your mother's Republican Party. It's not Tommy Thompson's Republican Party. It's Glenn Grothman's Republican Party. It's the Tea Party's Republican Party. It's Alex's Republican Party, the American Legislative Exchange Council's Republican Party. Dale Schultz, who also was a retiring Republican legislator, said about the American Legislative Exchange Council, I don't know why anyone would want to be a legislator if all you're going to do is grab a piece of legislation written by an outside group and introduce it as your own. So he got rid of the middleman, who was himself. There's a sadness, I think, with Mike Ellis, because he used to have a reputation as being someone who would stand on principle on some issues like campaign finance reform and go against his party when need be. But the thing that's going to stick in my mind anyway, and I think in the minds of thousands of Wisconsinites, is that image of him with that gavel during the debate over Act 10, banging the gavel down so hard that he broke it in an effort to shut up Senator Fred Risser. And he used, I believe, that expression and insisted that the distinguished old senator stop talking. And he was there, Mike Ellis, just being a stooge for Scott Walker. And I think he will regret that looking back.
Let me ask Steve, you can give us your answer too, but I also want to know why you think this conservative group was videotaping Mike Ellis undercover talking about this possible illegal campaign financing scheme. Why did a conservative group come in to target him?
I think they got tipped off somehow that I can't believe this is the first time that Mike discussed something like that, would be my guess. I don't know this personally, but, usually when reporters set up, for lack of a better term, sting operations, it's because they have a belief based on, off-the-record probably information that that something's going on. And that would be my guess as to why they did this. I've known Mike for quite a long time. Mike, I believe, got elected to the Assembly the first time in 1970, and I was 5 years old. So it's a little sad, frankly, because I think any reporter who covers politics in this state would tell you that Mike Ellis was a quote machine. If you got him talking, and it didn't take much to get him talking, I remember having an interview with him. I asked him like 2 questions, and 45 minutes later, we were still talking. And, that's a goldmine if you're a reporter. The other thing about Mike, that I can tell you a particular story that it just incredibly amuses me, at least. Back in 1996, I believe it was, the legislature was considering the 5-county sales tax to fund Miller Park. And Mike Ellis repeatedly said in public he was opposed to this tax, he was opposed to state help for the Brewers, and so he voted against it, and he worked to make sure that it got passed. So Mike was an interesting guy in politics, and you always are a little sad to see the interesting guys leave. I will tell you that I think as far as Tom Petri goes, I don't believe Glenn Grossman is going to end up as the nominee in that district. It's going to be Joe Liebem, I believe, the state senator from Sheboygan. But, back to Mike, it's when you have the colorful people leave, it's always a little bit sad if you're just a follower of politics.
Why do you think Glenn Grossman would not win that particular a Republican primary now that Petri stepped down? Other candidates are announcing that they would run. You think Joe Liebem would be the winner of that?
I believe he would be because, among other things, he lives in the district and Grossman doesn't. Now, Grossman, I beg your pardon, excuse me. Grossman is very popular in his own Senate district, the West Bend area. When the recalls all started in 2011, there was an effort to recall him, and it failed. They couldn't even get close to enough signatures. The last time he ran, I believe he was unopposed. So he's very popular among conservatives. That doesn't mean he's going to win that race. And if Liebem, I haven't seen for sure if Liebem's going to get in, but I believe he's considering it. And I think that if he does end up running, he automatically becomes the favorite to win the race. Liebem, that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything further on that, Matt? Glenn Grossman's maybe too conservative and a carpetbagger?
I wouldn't bet against Glenn Grossman. The base loves him. I think he's going to have a lot of money. He's a colorful politician. He loves a microphone. I think he's going, I think his popularity is one of the reasons that Petri got out. And I think it's very troubling to me, though, that the far right is going after people the way it is. I mean, that James O'Keefe, Mike Ellis thing, that was just a political hit.
Yeah, and this was someone who didn't like Mike Ellis's stand on the few times that maybe he broke away from the Republican.
Yeah, maybe
primary
on private school vouchers, because Ellis wasn't on this one carrying water for the Walker administration or for the charter school folks. So You know, Ellis, as Steve says, you know, runs off at the mouth sometimes. And so it may be that they didn't know that he was, you know, had this cockamamie idea about setting up an apparently illegal or considering setting up an apparently illegal campaign group and just thought, you know, if you start taping this guy for any stretch of time, he's going to say something embarrassing.
Yeah. You know, Steve, do you think that you cannot be a moderate in or a maverick in the Republican Party today?
Well, there are three people in the state Senate. Mike Ellis is one, Dale Schultz is the other, and Luther Olson from Ripon is the third, who are the, for lack of a better term, kind of the mischief makers. When the Republicans are not in charge in the Senate, there is no difference between their positions and the rest of their party. When they get the majority, they tend to like to make things a little more interesting. And, you know, two of those people are leaving. I think that to say, I mean, I don't disagree that moderates are, you know, finding a problem in the Republican Party, but I don't think it's safe to say that that is only the case in the Republican Party. You can go back to the 1990s, and I think Mike or Matt probably remembers this, when you had Scott Jensen, who was the Speaker of the State Assembly, Republican. You had Chuck Kwala, who is the Senate Majority Leader, Democrat, and I think you can look at those two as the reason that all of a sudden the moderates started to be purged out of both parties. It's difficult to find moderate Democrats anymore either. You know, you look at Tim Cullen is supposed to be a moderate Democrat. I don't think his voting record demonstrates that. It's, you know, there is a polarization going on in the state, but it is not merely on the Republican side, it's on the Democrat side also.
Well, it's not true, though. But, you know, Mary Burke is hardly a representative of the left wing, the Democratic Party, whereas here you got the governor who is a poster boy for the corporate sector of the Republican Party and the social conservatives.
Let me hold you both there as we have to take a short pause. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Republican Party of Wisconsin voting on a resolution about secession at their upcoming convention. We'll also talk a little bit about the Herb Kohl selling the Milwaukee Bucks and whether maybe taxpayers ought to pay a little bit to help build a new stadium for the Milwaukee Bucks. That's coming up. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up now, it's our Week in Review quiz. As you know, Governor Walker formally kicked off his reelection bid this week. Which popular music artist is warning him about using his songs on the campaign trail? So which popular music recording artist is speaking out about one of the songs Governor Walker used on his campaign launch this week? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We'll give you 5 minutes to call in or email in your answer or your guess. We'll randomly select a winner from all of the correct answers and announce the winner and the answer at the end of the program. All right, well, let's continue our review of the news of the week and ask Steve Prestigard first why the Republican Party of Wisconsin will consider at its convention next month a platform plank, a resolution that would support legislation for Wisconsin to reserve the right to secede under extreme circumstances, the United States of America. What's the deal with this?
Well, let's see. I haven't done the research, but I believe if you look at Democratic conventions in the past, you would see some things as far as resolutions that kind of make your head, your eyes roll.
Yeah, maybe also. So, but what about seceding the Union?
But as far as, I think what it is a demonstration, by the way, if you think it's going to make any difference with voters, I think that is not correct. I think what it is a symbol of is the polarization you're seeing in this state is not really different from the polarization you're seeing in the entire country. There are people in this country, and there are people who have jobs and go to church on Sundays and all of that, who truly believe that the federal government does not care at all what they believe. And I don't think I'd support secession even with the extreme circumstances. The idea of politics is to win elections, obviously, to get your way. But I think it is merely a symbol. You know, Matt, I'm sure, will use the word extreme at least five times in the next couple sentences, and he can do that. But I think it's a sign of the extreme polarization in this country, where you have people who truly believe that they are not being listened to and are not being represented in Washington.
So how extreme is this, Matt?
Well, I'm not going to use that word, but I am going to say that the crazies have totally, if not taken over the Republican Party of the state, have infiltrated it. And, you know, you have this kind of Confederate grouping within the Republican Party that wants to secede or consider seceding from the union. I mean, this is a real throwback. And it shows the hostility that some members of the far right of the Republican Party have to our entire system.
We had Mordecai Lee, a former state lawmaker, a professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee, on with us this week about this issue. And he said that this is traitorish. It's against the law. He was using words like treason and sedition, Matt.
Well, I don't like to use those words because, if you're guilty of treason, you can be executed, and I think people should be able to express themselves, even political beliefs that are out of the mainstream. But I do think it is a real far-out idea, and it suggests the hostility there is toward our system of government, toward the federal government. We've seen that, you know, with this rancher out west, and, you know, there's just a lot of anti-federal government sentiment that's just kind of free-floating out in the atmosphere now.
Yeah. Hey, what about this rancher out west, Steve? Are you on his side?
Honestly, I'm not sure if I am or not, because I have read from, you know, people who would be considered to be sympathetic to that point of view, different opinions as to whether he's right or not. But I can tell you this much. You wonder why there is such anti-government feeling, specifically in the western part of this country. And the Bureau of Land Management is one of those reasons. Nevada and Utah and some of these other states, there's actually more government-owned land than not government-owned land. And the Bureau of Land Management is supposed to be administering all the federal lands, and they are close to hated in that part of the country. That has gone on literally since about the late 1970s. So what's going on now is probably more extreme, but This is a sentiment as far as the opposition to the heavy-handedness of the federal government that's been going on for a long time in that part of the country.
Well, who has the heavy hand here is the question. Here you have this rancher who's refused to pay his grazing fees for 20 years, and when the government tries to get its money for that illegal grazing, he gets his buddies and their rifles out to have a vigilante standoff. And this idea that government-owned land is bad land, which is the suggestion Steve just made, you know, Yellowstone's bad, we're going to sell Yellowstone. I mean, Glacier National Park is bad, Yosemite's bad, Horicon Marsh is bad. I mean, those are all government-owned properties. Those are good properties. I'm glad the government owns it. I'm glad the public owns them.
Yeah, you know, other national headlines as we're talking about the top stories in state and national politics. I hate to call this politics, but Matt, your reaction to the shootings in Kansas City. Attorney General Eric Holder says all Americans are standing with the mourners of three people who were killed at Jewish community sites in suburban Kansas City, right around the eve of Passover, I believe it was, by a man who a lot of people say is an anti-Semite, who yelled, Heil Hitler, when he was taken away.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good evidence that he's an anti-Semite. And he was a former Klansman. I mean, I'm a Jewish American. I went to Passover this week with a group of friends here in Madison who've been celebrating Passover together for the past 30 years. And one of the women who wrote the Haggadah, the service, a brilliantly written service that she tailored from other Haggadahs and from her own insights about the world. Before she did her little reading from the Haggadah, she did mention how horrible this shooting was and what it means. And she explained it very well. She says, it just shows how much a mind can be contaminated by hate. And I think that's what we need to keep in mind, be mindful of, the power of hate, the ugly power of hate.
Steve, your thoughts?
You know, I'm not a favorite of the death. I'm not a fan of the death penalty, but this guy deserves whatever he gets, and if that includes the death penalty, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it. This is just unconscionable.
Yeah. Oh, you know, it reminds me, Matt. We didn't share the story, but what is going on in Ukraine and the targeting of Jews in Ukraine?
Well, I mean, there's no good guy in Ukraine. There are, you know, there's the president who was a Putin puppet, and now there's this new government that has real neo-Nazi fascist elements in it. That again, you talk about this guy who did the shooting here, saying Heil Hitler. These people give the Hitler salute and wear swastikas, and so it's very disturbing over in the Ukraine right now.
Yes. Apparently, there was a memo circulated in a Ukrainian city. It's not known exactly who is responsible, asking Jews to register with the local government. The local government is denying any involvement. Your thoughts, Steve, on what's happening in Ukraine?
What's that? What's the phrase from George Santayana? Those who did not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. If I was Jewish and lived in the Ukraine, I would be extremely concerned right now when things like that happen. To say that you know things can't escalate from well, you just have to register. To say that things can't you know get much worse from that, I don't think that's true.
Yeah. Well,
to say that things can't escalate and things get much worse for the Jewish population of that part of the world.
It's maybe on a nicer note. It's Good Friday. Yesterday, Pope Francis washed the feet of 12 elderly and disabled people, including women and non-Catholics, at a pre-Easter ritual designed to show his willingness to serve like a slave. Matt, your thoughts on Pope Francis? We did just talk about the Pope Francis effect. Do you think that Pope Francis is good for the Catholic Church?
Oh, I sure do. I really admire Pope Francis, and I think he deserved to be a Person of the Year, and I think he's done just remarkable things, shocking things, really, turning the Catholic Church around here and trying to give it a new life. And I admire his humility. I admire his openness. I admire the fact that he says, "Who am I to judge if two men want to marry or if they're in a homosexual relationship?" He's making the church more open to Catholics who have become so disenchanted with it over the years, and that's a good thing for within the church and for outside the churches, and generally in society. His talk about poverty, his critique of capitalism. I mean, I think this is a real visionary leader with a lot of moral heft.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
You know, it's interesting because at work I got an email actually yesterday from an organization I have not heard of, but they are specifically calling on Bishop Morlino to do what the Pope did and what he apparently refuses to do, which is to wash the feet of women. It's a You know, the belief is that because Jesus' 12 apostles were men, that you can't wash women's feet in the Holy Thursday Mass, which obviously took place yesterday. And Pope doesn't seem to agree with that. And I think as a former Catholic, as somebody who was raised Catholic, I think it's going to be really interesting to see when the Pope, if he does, starts telling the cardinals and the bishops, including the more conservative ones, like Bishop Morlino, to knock off what they're doing to, you know, the things like going back to the days when only boys could be altar boys, and to, you know, essentially going back to pre-Vatican II days, which is what at least it looks like has been going on with certain of the more Catholic elements in the Catholic Church leadership.
Let's see. We have time to talk about. Unless you wanted to add something.
Well, I just think Bishop Morlino ought to get his resume together, because I don't think his job is very secure right now. I mean, when he's asked about, you know, the Pope's comments, his liberal comments, and the bishop says, "Oh, the Pope is just being misinterpreted." I mean, if I'm the Pope in the Vatican, I'm going to want to send a message here to Wisconsin.
Well, here's something completely different. Former U.S. Senator Herb Kohl wants to sell the Milwaukee Bucks to two New York-based hedge fund managers. The pair have said that they will keep the Bucks in Milwaukee and contribute $200 million toward a new arena. There still is some talk, including from a Milwaukee alderperson, that perhaps a regional sales tax might be needed to help construct a new arena for the Bucks. Your reaction, Steve, to the Bucks being sold, and whether regional taxpayers ought to chip in to build a new arena?
The first thought I have, and this will make Matt's head explode, is this demonstrates why Wisconsin needs more rich people, because they had to get two from New York in this case. And, of course, Mark Attanasio, who bought the Brewers, was from California. As far as the regional tax goes, remember that when Brown County passed a sales tax to do the renovations at Lambeau Field, that was by referendum. When Miller Park got its tax proceeds, that was not by referendum. If they're going to put public money into a new arena, the voters, I think, really need to be able to say yay or nay on it. I don't believe that there should be, similar to what happened with Miller Park, legislature just passes a tax and nobody has any say about it among the voters. The Bucks certainly do not have a statewide following. In fact, it's not really outside the 414 or 262 area codes. And, you know, tax increases, I think the voters ought to get to be able to decide whether they occur or not anyway.
And Matt, your thoughts on the Bucks?
Well, I actually agree with Steve on the taxpayer issue. I don't think public funds should go to supporting, you know, private owners to build a stadium that's going to make the private owners rich, or richer for that matter. I do think Herb Kohl should be applauded for trying to keep the Bucks in Milwaukee. He found some owners who say they will try to do that. So I hope they do. I'm still kind of mad at Herb Kohl for trading Ray Allen, but that goes back a ways, and I'm upset he didn't run against Scott Walker during the recall, but those are other issues.
Let me congratulate Stephen LaCrosse. He's the winner of the Week in Review quiz this week. We will send him a fabulous prize. Which popular music artist is warning Governor Walker about using his songs on the campaign trail? Well, it's John Mellencamp. Walker played Pink Houses at his rallies on Tuesday. Mellencamp didn't say Walker couldn't use the songs, but wanted Walker to know that Mellencamp is pro-union and collective bargaining. So we have less than a minute to go. Steve, what should Governor Walker play at his campaign rally?
You know, for his demographic, I can think of a number of songs by country artists that I think are much more appropriate. He could also play the Beatles' Taxman, too.
Less than 15 seconds, Matt. Do you have a suggestion for him or not?
No, I don't.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. Matt Rothschild and Steve Prestigard. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network.